One, hold the paper up. One, two, three.
You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
All right, Majority Report listeners, we have a final deal. As you know, Credo is sponsoring the show for the rest of 2013, just a couple more days. We have a final deal that ends on New Year's Eve. You will be able to get, with Credo Mobile, a free Google Nexus 5 and an up to $350 buyout credit. That means they'll give you a credit on your Credo bill for up to $350 to get you out of your own old contract, plus a free Google Nexus 5. You know all about Credo Action. They fight for progressive values. Credo Mobile gives 1% of its revenue to fund progressive nonprofits. Check it out. Go to credomobile.com/Sam for your deal. This is only good until the end of the year, and then it all goes away. CredoMobile.com/Sam. We've got links on the front page of Majority.fm. Check it out now.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, December 26, 2013. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. It's a best of 2013, ladies and gentlemen. And today for you, we have an interview that I did with Mike Konzel back in April of 2013. He's a Roosevelt Fellow. And specifically, this one's a little bit wonky, folks. But the reason why we've included in the best of is because this is when we talked about the debunking of the Reinhard Rogoff study, which has been the sort of the foundation of the academic and elite classes, I guess, justification for austerity measures. And the story of how this, the Reinhard Rogoff study was debunked is really important as we go forward, because hopefully that debunking will not allow us to get mired in austerity for too long. We're there now, and it's had disastrous effects in terms of our economy and in terms of particularly folks who have been stuck in poverty, folks who are in cyclical poverty, people who have had, who have lost their homes, people who have lost their jobs. In many ways, the Reinhard Rogoff study has brought us all sorts of serious suffering. So this made it important enough for us to want to put it in our 2013 best ofs. I hope you had a happy Christmas, if that's what you celebrate, that you didn't get a piece of coal in your sock or whatever it is that, you know, you get when you've been bad.
You gave us a bit of a George W. Bush laugh there.
There you go.
Somebody got coal.
I'll tell you who got coal in their stocking. Everybody. That's what I gave out. It's just a little jokey gift that, and you don't want to ruin the joke by actually giving them a real present. So, here is Mike Konzel. I know that I am now still probably somewhat mildly inebriated. That's just the way that I roll at this time of the year when I am visiting my in-laws dealing with the kids and all of the wonderful recriminations that happen after, you know, you haven't given the proper present to someone or whatever it is. So I hope you're enjoying your post-holidays. Hopefully you have another couple of days off. We'll be back at the beginning of January. So here's my console, and of course, we'll add some bonus stuff maybe today. Maybe, I'm not sure. Whatever Matt has in store for you, you know how he rolls. All right, folks, here's that interview with my console. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program after really too long, ladies and gentlemen. Mike Consigal, a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. Welcome to the program, Mike.
It has been too long. Thanks for having me on.
Let me just say that I am very proud of the fact that on this program we're going to be able to spend as much time to something that some people would perceive as an obscure fight that is taking place in sort of very narrow economic circles. But the implications of the Rogoff-Reinhardt study have been rather large in terms of the shadow that study has cast on our policies and or at least the justifications for our policies. And specifically the austerity, the policies of austerity that we have been subjected to in this country and in Europe, frankly, over the past couple of years. Just tell us what the Rogoff-Reinhardt study is.
So Kenneth Rogoff is an economist at Harvard, also with the IMF. He was affiliated with the IMF. Carmen Reinhardt is also an economist. They wrote a paper in 2010. Now, if you remember back to 2010, there was a big debate about should there be an additional round of stimulus, what should be done in Europe in particular. And they wrote a paper that said if you get above 90% debt to GDP, which is to say if your debt's approaching what you make in 1 year, which is what the U.S. Debt was approaching and sort of would have come to, and what Europe had already gone past, you have a real decline in growth. Growth drops off from what it would normally be. On average, which this is one of their big headline reports, is that it would go negative. And crucially, they pitched this as almost like a cliff, right? Like it was a zone that once you were in, it wasn't that it just got a little bit worse. It got, you know, significantly worse. So it was really a danger zone to be avoided. This had a real outsized impact on the debate and convinced, I mean, there's a lot of people who wanted austerity and were willing to take whatever excuse they had. But I think there's a lot of, like, especially centrist Democrats who were nervous about stimulus and nervous about debt to GDP. And this gave them an excuse to go much harder against, you know, trying to do something about unemployment and slow growth.
Tim Fernholz recounts that a passage from a book by Senator Tom Coburn on U.S. debt. And he recounts the time where Rogoff and Reinhardt met with 40 senators. I mean, that's, you know, 40 senators. That's a big deal in 2011. And the exchanges that took place there where Rogoff, you know, where Johnny Isaacson said, do we need to act this year? Is it better to act quickly? Absolutely, Rogoff said. Not acting moves the risk closer. You have very few levers at this point, he warned us. It went on to say that Kent Conrad seemed to really absorb what Rogoff was saying, that this was going to diminish our GDP, our growth, rather, by 25 to 33%. You had
Tim Geithner, who was the secretary treasurer at the time, saying it's an excellent study, although in some ways maybe it's understated. He lists all of it. That 90% threshold is cited in Paul Ryan's budget. European Commissioner Olli Rehn cites it. I mean, on and on and on. It's cited over and over again. And I will just tell you that from a non sort of like policy perspective, my brother-in-law, who, you know, God bless him, is, absorbs things rather quickly, and is a business guy, considers himself one of those sort of non-ideological people, states this over and over again, this mantra. I don't know if he knows the names Rogoff and Reinhardt, but this has had incredible impact, at least in our politics, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And then you remember, there isn't events like the Great Depression, like the Great Recession we just went through, don't happen very often, right? So we often don't know about what happens to economies when they go into it. So, I mean, even though the conventional sense is still true, right? Like the Federal Reserve is having trouble acting, so fiscal stimulus we know will boost employment. The idea of debt really far out there is kind of unknown, right? The last time the United States had this was during the end of the Great Depression when we were ramping up for World War II and also had massive full employment and perfect growth. So there's not really like a good set of data sets. So the fact that two really, preeminent economists really put this out there, and then also they're denying this now, aggressively put muscle into it. I mean, as you said, they met with 40 senators, which how often do people get to meet with 40 senators, is really telling me. It was really an important intellectual building block of the global movement towards austerity in the early 2010s.
Okay, so now you write a piece yesterday that basically summarizes in some respects a study by three economists from UMass, and people referring to them as Ham. It essentially takes apart the Reinhardt-Rogoff study, and other people have done that in the past, and we'll talk about the problems they've had. But why don't you list for us who it was that did that study and what they found and why their study is unique in terms of having access to the original data?
So there's always a question about the causation, right? You always hear correlations, not causation. The correlation they found, there's always a big debate about whether or not Reinhardt and Rogoff were essentially reading their results backwards and whether or not a weak economy was causing higher debt, which makes perfect sense. But no one had been able to reproduce the data or reproduce their results. Most of the data, in fact, all of it by now, has been publicly available, but their methodology is really opaque in the paper. They don't use all the data. It's not clear how they do stuff. And so no one's actually been able to replicate it, to take apart the pieces and show, reporters who are very influenced by this results how it works. Finally, three researchers at UMass Amherst, Thomas Hernan, Michael Ash, and Robert Pollan, brilliant economists. They were able to get the actual – one of them spent basically a year trying to reverse engineer it, could not do it. So they finally got them, Reinhardt and Rogoff, to send their original spreadsheet. And then it was very clear what they were doing and why no one was able to replicate it.
Okay. So let's go through. There were essentially three problems they found with the Reinhardt-Rogoff study, and the sort of save the most sort of like spectacular one, I guess, and the most flamboyant error for last. It may be the least significant in some respects, but in other respects, I happen to think it's the most significant. But take us through those three problems that they found.
Sure. So the first two have to do with the data. Reinhardt and Rogoff do not use periods in the 1940s and the early 1950s for several countries that have both high debt loads and high growth. Canada is one. New Zealand, they exclude all the years that were high growth and high debt, and just took the last year, which actually had very low growth, like negative 7%, like a very severe recession. New Zealand's a very small country, even at that point. So the fact that they're weighing it against the United States, for instance, I think is really problematic. But crucially, they exclude certain years in a way that seems incredibly problematic. The second is that
I just want to dwell on that for a second, so that people understand what you're saying here is that they have theoretically the data set that they can use, right? Goes back, I guess, 100 to 115 years or so, and they choose specific data set that. That seems pretty arbitrary and capricious, right? I mean, it's like why this year as opposed to that year? Could anybody make any heads or tails about it when they've responded to this? I mean, do they explain why we chose to use these years and not those years?
Especially for their headline results, the one that all the congressmen were worried about, they look from essentially the mid 40s onward. So it's only 100, I think it's 110 data points that are actually really high debt of you know, 20 countries or so. And they throw out 15 immediately. So this is a substantial part of the set, right? This is, you know, about 10 or 15% of the data set is tossed. And they all tend to be years with high growth and high debt. And it's, that's really problematic. I mean, it's very obvious, and it has a significant effect on the final thing.
It's very problematic.
Now, the second thing they do is they weigh it in such a way, which is to say, you know, it's always difficult. You have to, someone who's working with data, you have to make decisions about what counts and what doesn't and how you're, you know, weighing things or what are you trying to compare. They compare countries overall. So, for instance, the 1 year of New Zealand they find that's really bad is given the equal weight of 19 years in England, in the UK, that has, you know, 2.5% growth on average. It's actually a pretty good run of high debt for them. And they say, you know, one's negative 7%, one's 2.5%, therefore, you know, it averages out to negative 4% or whatever it would be. Negative 3% because it has equal weighting. It's a really obtuse way to weight it, and it's obviously the weighting you'd use if you really wanted to amplify small and consequential one-off years, like from a small country like New Zealand.
I am not good at math, and I can't imagine anyone I know who is further whose abilities in these areas. Is less than mine, who's willing to actually even entertain a conversation about it. But it seems to me that if you have 19 years of a major, one of the largest economies in the world, functioning with high debt and high growth, and to give that equal balance as New Zealand's 1 year of high debt, negative growth, that just seems... It just seems bizarre to me. How do they justify that?
Well, they dance around it. They haven't particularly responded. I mean, they've just sent out another thing a little while ago. I'm trying to argue about this. I think so. I mean, we'll talk about the third thing as well. On one hand, you could make an argument for why this might be a good way to weigh it. But the two things that should stand out is one is that they didn't disclose that they were doing this. They did not make their techniques and methodology available to other people. You know, people like Dean Baker, a prominent liberal think tanker, have been asking for years about their methodology and their data, and they've just ignored it. So, transparency is ultimately a good disinfectant here. And so the fact that they weren't disclosing it, and once people started to be able to see what was going on, it was very clear how problematic it was. And it means that they ultimately should have been hedging these statements that they were making to people like senators, people like journalists. I mean, these results were widely cited by journalists, which is how it circulated into the greater kind of public discourse, which is why random people would know about this. The fact that that stuff was missing and the third error makes it really, it's really problematic.
Yes, let's talk about the third error because in some ways I think the policy wonks and experts are saying this actually has the smallest impact on their findings. But in my estimation, it's going to have the largest political impact.
Right. So what happens is they actually did this in an Excel spreadsheet, and the researchers were able to get a hold of the Excel spreadsheet. And it should be worth noting one more time that people have been trying very hard to replicate these results, and they couldn't. And one reason they couldn't is because the research actually drops 5 countries of the results. And remember that they're averaging by country, so they essentially drop another 16 results. Now, they drop it because they accidentally mistype something into an Excel formula. So if you go Next New Deal is where my write-up of it is. I actually was able to get a snapshot from the authors of the actual error. And you can see that, you know, the blue box, if you use Excel every day to do office supplies or your home budget or whatever it is, the blue box is supposed to average all the countries, and they only average, I think, 15 out of the 20 countries.
Now, can I just say that I find Excel spreadsheets to be a huge pain. But I mean, this, you know, that's, I don't have cause to use them in the way that necessarily, how does something like that happen? I mean, don't theoretically they have, you know, research assistants who say, hey, you know what, there's 20, you should be, averaging 20 countries, and it seems like you're only averaging 15. How does that happen?
So one reason it happens is because these, you know, the methodology and the data was not peer reviewed or released for public comment. I mean, Dean Baker would have caught that in 30 seconds if it was published. You know, the researchers at Amherst, Ash, Pollan, and Herzon, like, found it very quickly. The other thing, I mean, just as a practical matter, if you're in Excel and you're constantly adding data or removing data, sometimes things don't update when you think they did. It's conceptually easy to see how they could screw it up, but it's really unforgivable that this was not available for public discourse. I think a lot of people, in practice, that doesn't matter too much, right? So the actual results, it does have a significant change. And a lot of people, and it, obviously the fact that the results that the researchers find is very dependent on the data sources and the weighting. But I think it's important to emphasize, I mean, you know, this argument has justified 30% unemployment in Spain. It's justified the sequestration, which is leading to Medicare cuts. It's justified a grand bargain by President Obama that's going to slash Social Security for elderly widows. Like, it's the intellectual foundation for some really terrible stuff in the world. And the fact that when you really look at it, I mean, it's just goofy, the kind of stupid mistakes that were made. I think people should really understand what the clay feet, the kind of emperor has no clothes of this austerity movement.
Yeah, I mean, what's fascinating to me about this is that, you know, this study, I've interviewed many economists, and this study has come up. I mean, I just interviewed Mark Blythe last week, and when I say Reinhard Rogoff, he, you know, quickly dismissed it for the causal connections and for saying that the data is a little bit dicey. There seems to have been, I mentioned this to Bill Black the other day before this stuff came out. He had the same response. There has been a consistent, you know, Krugman has been out there for some time, obviously Dean Baker. In many respects, it seems to me that there was at least, if not a broad consensus, there was some significant consensus that this study was problematic, particularly from the perspective of it being of the causal relationship. And in fact, I think in the first response that Reinhard and Rogoff sent after your piece came out, was something to the effect of, like, we never pushed the causal connection. It was
an association, was their word.
Yeah, yes. And that is, you know, I mean, anybody can make associations, right? I mean, that's also, you know, it just so happened that this was a period of time where, you know, cars were really popular. I mean, but what's fascinating,
when people carry umbrellas, it causes it to rain, right?
Right. That's an exactly. And what's fascinating to me about this is that it is the Excel spreadsheet mistake, I think, you know, despite the fact that represents in terms of the actual computations, a relatively minor problem for their computations, it seems like that's going to be the thing that actually has the most political currency.
Well, I think I think the fact that, well, it's tough to tell what's going to travel with people. I think to general readers, I think they're just, I think there's something comical about it, but I think there's also kind of evidence of sloppiness, something that was not caught. Like from a higher end econometric results, like, you know, maybe you should be able to throw out data by randomness, which is clearly what they did. I mean, it's random by the alphabet. But I think it's a good immediate cue that something went wrong. This was not quality controlled. It was not peer reviewed. It was not opened up to a group of their peers to be examined and, you know, cross examined. So I do actually think that it's worthwhile to have it as a good marker, though understanding, and I put an update in my write up, and then the authors from Amherst themselves strictly emphasize that, you know, the other things are really the selective data and the unconventional weighting are really what's kind of tilting this into negative territory for them.
I want to just sort of transition this conversation slightly to a piece that Peter Fraze, I think I may be mispronouncing his name, from the sociology department at the CUNY Graduate Center, wrote about the perils of wonkery in regards to this, because the Reinhart-Rogoff study sort of traveled a lot through the sort of wonk journalist osphere, if you will. And in many respects, just when you present the findings of this piece and say, you know, on the other hand, there are some people like Paul Krugman or Dean Baker who say, you know, the causal implications of this are a little bit off. He criticizes them for I guess, you know, something that we've mentioned on this program, that, you know, there's a hidden ideology there in this type of journalism. And I think this aspect of it with the Excel spreadsheet sort of brings that out, because it just seems to me that you will never see on television, or you will never see in the debates that take place where the rubber meets the road, where, you know, if Paul Krugman sits down with Paul Ryan and debates Rogoff-Reinhart yesterday, or 2 days ago, it gets into the weeds and people lose sight of it. If he says they couldn't even get an Excel spreadsheet to work, the conversation's over. I mean, that's what's so fascinating about this to me.
Right. So Peter Fraze, who is also an editor at a magazine called Jacobin, wrote the piece essentially argues a couple of things. But one thing is that wonk bloggers, or basically any reporter who talks about policy for a living, is uniquely suited for kind of something some people call source capture, which is that they're very dependent on the people they're reporting on to influence how they understand things, right? A lot of journalists will not have academic training, nor should they. But if they're writing on a very complicated economic issue, they're going to have to rely on economists, particularly the people who are involved with that debate, for guidance. And, you know, or they're reading papers, and they can read the, you know, introduction, conclusion, and kind of the headline results, but they can't quite, they don't have the sophistication to understand the little miniature debates that are really deep in there. I mean, that's a problem for all journalism, and it's a problem in part for this. The political consequences, as you alluded to and Peter does, is that especially when you're dealing with like the deficit or economists who often are kind of reactionary, the consensus is between a very kind of deficit hawk neoliberalish view and then a like super reactionary conservative view. So like actual genuine, you know, progressivism is like completely missing from the dialogue, right? Krugman is thankfully a breath of fresh air on this stuff, but like, you know, when you read economists on the deficit, some think we need immediate austerity and some think, you know, we need mild austerity, as opposed to like, don't care about the deficit, give everyone a job and the deficit will take care of itself, which is actually the correct answer. But, you know, that's not necessarily the elite, opinionated, like, serious answer, which is what will then inform the journalism. And Reinhart and Rogoff are like ground zero for their paper in particular, is ground zero for that kind of seriousness. We need to, you know, be willing to take a lot of pain to make sure the deficit stays still. You know, that kind of journalism, which is one reason why I think this report percolated so far across the entire public sphere.
I mean, it's interesting, and I don't want to I don't want to be hyperbolic about this, but in some respects, we can see the same sort of dynamic. I mean, there's a certain sort of structural issue here, as it was with Iraq in some way. There's a certain amount of credentialism that is involved here. And when two esteemed economists from Harvard say this is what it is, it is risky for you to maintain your status as someone who is taken seriously, because you need to be taken seriously on both ends of it, right? You need to be taken seriously by your audience, and you need to be taken seriously by your sources. And on some level, there's a balancing act there. And the way that you're taken seriously by your audience is to be, in some ways, taken seriously by your sources. And it's this sort of credentialism that is sort of embedded in there. And particularly if you are one of those people who don't necessarily have the ability to sort of say, like, you know, I've broken down your spreadsheet and there's a problem here. So you have to almost take what they're saying. To me, it seems to really be a very strong argument, again, for transparency, because this is always – it's that black box that always seems to bring us to this point.
And transparency, you know, it's even worse, and this is an analogy to the Iraq War where source capture was definitely in play, is the elite self-policing is just broken down, right? Like, Reinhardt and Rogoff are not going to be reprimanded by the economist professions, right? Where other kinds of, like, you know, scientists, like biologists, if they try to, you know, move really bad data on other biologists, will be, like, you know, punished for it in hard or soft ways. You know, how many economists thought Wall Street was going to deliver all this prosperity in the 2000s, or thought the recession would be no big deal, or freaked out about the deficit, all of which turned out to be absolutely wrong. And, you know, no one's lost their jobs. No one's been punished, you know, in any, even in a social way. And the same thing with Iraq, right? All the warmongers who were, you know, were cheerleading the drum march to war, or, you know, directly, personally attacking critics of the Iraq war in the buildup, none of them lost jobs, right? They're right. Still in think tanks. They're still – they would have taken over the Romney administration. They still float around in Democratic circles. So, like, that lack of transparency, which is super necessary, but also just, like, a general shaming of the elites when they screw up in a major way and a new – you know, I think that's also really important.
So how does this – I mean, give me your sense of how this – you know, how this winds its way. I mean, what should we be looking for in terms of – this chipping away at that, and what needs to happen to chip away at that underpinnings of austerity? I mean, obviously, at this point, we're not going to see President Obama come on television tomorrow and say, hey, guys, this is a little bit embarrassing, and I'm speaking for, you know, a lot of the folks in the Senate. You know that whole thing about tightening the family's belts and us tightening our belts and whoops. You know, I mean, how does it do you think this is going to reverberate in the circles of power where it needs to, and how does that happen?
So it's important to understand what was actually disproven and what is off the table. What Rogoff and Reinhardt are now retreating from in their public statements is the idea that there's a cliff, right? If we get beyond a debt to GDP ratio, we're in a lot of trouble. They're essentially arguing to a much weaker, minor drop off that I think a lot of people would concede, though there's not enough data to justify it. So that's really important, which means that there's no, if we try to take action while we have a weak economy, as we should, there's no other thing that's going to, like, sneak in and destroy the country. Now, obviously, in power, there's a lot of people who would really like an austerity agenda. They want to radically shift the balance of power from the poor to the rich. They would like to dismantle the federal social insurance network. They'd like to do other things as well, especially in Europe. So I don't think they're going to be dissuaded. I think hopefully people who think that maybe we were doing too much from 2008 to 2010 and then got really nervous about the deficit will understand now that we didn't do enough. There's still plenty we could do. We could build infrastructure. We could reinstate the payroll tax. We could avoid the stupid sequestration. And that would not actually hurt us or put us in some sort of weird danger zone, but instead would be an appropriate response that would actually really rebuild the economy.
Yeah, we can only hope, I guess, at this point. But, Mike, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for your piece, which has created really in in many circles, just a firestorm. You're basically translating this study, but it was fascinating to watch, and I hope it reverberates. And I just hope that we get to see somebody on a Sunday show mock somebody espousing this study by using the Excel spreadsheet. Some really good pithy phrase about it.
One can hope. All thanks right. for having me on.
Thanks, Mike.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Brooks, filling in for Sam Seder. This is the Majority Report. Joining us now is Professor Juan Cole. He blogs at Informed Comment. He's a professor at the University of Michigan and really one of the most foremost authorities of the Middle East and national security in the United States, in my view, and the cause of me sounding really particularly and exceptionally informed at dinner parties sometimes about the Middle East. How are you, Professor Cole?
Just fine. How are you?
I'm doing really well.
Good to be back.
Congrats. I'm glad to have you back. And that does sound much, much better. So as I was saying before we got cut off, you have a new post that you wrote kind of comparing the political culture around Second Amendment protections or fanatical interpretations of Second Amendment for, protections as related to gun rights, obviously, and the kind of political constituency of the gun lobby, versus our willingness to kind of continually erode and roll back Fourth Amendment protections, which is exactly what these disclosures have kind of highlighted over the past couple of days. And you say that there isn't a kind of similar corporate constituency that's interested in those types of protections. And you know, that makes a lot of sense. I'm just wondering if you could kind of elaborate on that.
Well, sure. Well, you know, there are about four big manufacturers of pistols, of handguns, Glocks, and so forth. And then there are a limited number of manufacturers of assault weapons. And they're making billions off of this stuff. And so whenever we have these school shootings or massacres carried out, and they can only be carried out on, you know, on a mass level with those kinds of semi-automatic weapons.
Sure.
Whenever there's a public debate about whether something could be done about this or should be done about this, and we have 30,000 gun deaths a year if you count the suicides, it's shut down. And we saw recently that even a democratically controlled Senate couldn't even report out any kind of reform on this issue, and it's because politicians get elected by campaign contributions from corporations, and there are lobbies like the National Rifle Association that act as pass-through for these huge arms manufacturers. So they just shut down the debate on this because they have a very strong interest in a fundamentalist and somewhat, you know, ahistorical and weird interpretation of the Second Amendment, that everybody has a right to semi-automatic weapons and huge ammunition rolls attached. But with regard to the Fourth Amendment, which forbids the government to search through our personal effects and papers to come on our property without a warrant from a judge and without a very narrow specification of what exactly they're looking for and what is the reason for which they suspect that a criminal act is being committed, with regard to the Fourth Amendment, there's been no effective pushback at all from the corporations in Congress with regard to lobbying and so forth on preserving those rights. There's nobody that makes money off of preventing intrusions into our personal privacy.
Right. Well, I mean, it seems quite the contrary, in fact. There's a lot of money to be made in pretty intrusive data mining and other technologies that sort of violate our privacy on a pretty regular basis. And then what we've seen here is this kind of parallel between maybe some of the more encroaching habits of some Silicon Valley firms and then what the NSA has been doing. And obviously that's kind of highlighted in this PRISM program. You had there's sort of two parts of this that I kind of wanted to get to. One is that, and I think it relates very directly to the kind of corporate component, because the firms, the Silicon Valley firms, have denied pretty not very – it sounds blunt, but actually if you kind of read it, it's a very parsed denial of having a role in these programs in terms of giving the NSA direct access to their servers. There's, you know, the other possibilities that the NSA asks directly for access, and they're granted on a particular basis or with specific requests, like with the phone records, or the other possibility is that they're kind of being filtered through a third party. But I guess what I'm curious for you about is this kind of disparity between the kind of expansion of government overreach and then the kind of extreme limits that we're also placing on ourselves, both in our private and public lives when we interact with these companies or when we're being monitored by the government, that how that sort of parallel is playing out.
Yes, well, of course, the internet companies, some of them have aspirations of developing a kind of hologram of each of us that they would know all of our likes and dislikes, our location. At one point, the head of Google wanted to have it be such that if you were out of town, you were visiting another city, that Google could tell you where your favorite restaurant was probably, and then which cinema house you might like to go to, and so forth. In order to commercialize the internet,
right,
they would like to have total information awareness about their customers, just as the U.S. government would like to have total information awareness about its citizens. And so those two things work together, and in fact, one justifies the other. So very often, National Security Agency or CIA or other officials, when pressed on government intrusions into our electronic privacy, will say, well, we give away that information quite freely to Jeff Zuckerberg or to Google, so why would we mind so much if the government also gets it?
Right, right. And I think then that the sort of notion as well that this kind of encroachment has been a portrayal by President Obama of kind of his affinity for geek culture or the technology industry. In fact, it hasn't been a betrayal. It's actually run, as you say, quite parallel to the policies of these companies. Obviously, you know, this is sort of happening in the context, this is happening in the context of the Bradley Manning trial. And you said that really what this guy, Snowden, has done and what Bradley Manning did is sort of turn the tables on what government has been doing to us. And I was curious if you could elaborate on that as well.
Sure. Well, there's now a government class.
Right.
There's a class of people with security clearances who can dip into your privacy at will without a warrant,
right,
under certain circumstances. It's not that they can necessarily listen to your phone calls without a warrant, but there are various forms of surveillance that they can put people under at will. And so essentially there's a class of people because of their government connections, and many of these, by the way, are contractors.
Right.
They have security clearances, but they're being provided to the government by private firms. So it's not just government employees. So that you what
well,
you
like
call
the like the leaker himself. I mean, he was an employee at Booz Allen, right?
Yes, that's right. He at the time that he became aware of PRISM, and when he blew the whistle on it, he wasn't a direct employee of the U.S. government. But he says that he could if Barack Obama was using a Gmail account, that he could just go look at the emails. even of the president. In any case, this sort of surveillance class exists with security clearances and access to these monitoring technologies. And the rest of us are second class. We don't have access to that. We don't know what they're doing. So, you know, President Obama came out on Friday and said, well, now that this is out, he'd be glad to have a debate. It seemed to me one of the worst moments of his presidency because it was so disingenuous that
right. He
had not allowed us to have a debate because all of these programs and activities are secret and classified. And indeed, Ron Wyden, who represents Oregon in the Senate, knew about it and could not reveal it to us. He could sort of signal that we wouldn't like it if we knew what was going on, but that was the limit of what he could say. So we couldn't have a debate because everything is classified, and even bringing it up is now being portrayed as a kind of treason. So what these whistleblowers are doing is subjecting the surveillance class to the kind of monitoring and surveillance of them by the public that they do to the public every day.
Yeah, it's a kind of almost informational equivalent of the kind of 99% versus the 1%. And it's an interesting and disturbing parallel. There's two more questions I wanted to get with you, get to you on this theme. One, going back to President Obama, I agree with you. I think that it was an incredibly disingenuous and unfortunate moment. But I think it was there's a continuity there. That's the same attitude he's taken on drones and covert actions abroad, which is hold information incredibly tightly, try to keep these programs as under wraps as possible, and then as sort of they emerge, then he kind of adopts this I want a kind of open society, big debate position. And what do you make of that as a political habit he's making for himself in terms of every time these things emerge, immediately adopting a position which seems directly contradictory of what he has been, in fact, practicing?
Yeah, well, I like President Obama quite a lot and support most of his policies. But he, like Bill Clinton, really has a blind spot on security issues, and it may come with being in the office. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I think, he spent a lot of time in Chicago being a community organizer and has been slammed for that background. But what a community organizer does is go to a community and try to help them figure out what they want and how to get it. And so I think when a really controversial issue arises, Obama, and he did this with health care and with gun control and so forth, instead of being presidential and sort of leading and making decisions and taking on interests, he falls into this community organizer mode, and he says, well, okay, so we've got a nation that's divided and there are different views. What do you really want and how could we help you to get it? I think it's just his background that leads him to think that way.
So you think it's his background to sort of adopt this kind of multi-stakeholder and synthesis approach, which is okay.
I think it's a flaw in him with regard to being president, because a smart president who wanted health care in the United States would have had a bill written and taken it to Nancy Pelosi and Reid and said, pass this.
Right.
But he didn't. He called the Republicans in and said, how could we make you happy?
Right, right. No, that's precisely, what he did. Absolutely. I mean, I guess the one way that I might push back on that a bit, though, is I do think with healthcare, the process was flawed, but he was pushing it in a certain direction. Whereas it does seem with some of these security policies, almost reading him in retrospect, even when he was critical when he campaigned, was he critical not of any of the substance of these programs, but in the kind of lawless and cavalier way that the Bush administration did them? And he all along has been pretty comfortable about kind of implementing and carrying out these relatively, kind of aggressive approaches to surveillance and covert actions. So that I kind of wonder about.
Yeah, well, he's very devoted to that. And,
yeah,
of course, he campaigned against Bush that he wasn't using drones enough. So
right.
He has a hardline side to him, which people sometimes don't realize. And, again, if you were... Elected a Democratic president after a long time of Republican rule, and the bureaucracy is full of Bush appointees, and you're afraid of information being used against you in invidious ways. This cult of secrecy that he and Holder have, and this intolerance of whistleblowing, and this fear, really, of information being used to manufacture scandals, I think comes out of this long period in the wilderness that the Democrats had, and the awareness that the Republicans are perfectly willing to play these games. And I think,
there
have been public officials who have been damaged by these kinds of techniques.
Right. No, that makes perfect sense. I think the another important question to kind of get to hopefully sort of wrap this section up, though, and I think it's important to reflect on, is it seems to me that, and maybe I'm being a bit like President Obama myself here, but I hear these two kind of dominant threads when we talk about terrorism and whether or not these programs are justified. And then I kind of one extreme, there's the kind of September 11th repeater brigade and, Al-Qaeda's at your doorstep. Terrorism is the most kind of vital national security threat we've ever faced. And then on the other extreme, maybe there's some people who would tend to, in the process of rightly criticizing some of these policies, I think personally to a degree overlook the fact that, no, there actually are legitimate and real security challenges that the United States faces from groups like Al-Qaeda, and President Obama does legitimately need to make some hard decisions about. And I'm just wondering what your sort of overall take is now on what is the quality of that threat to the United States right now?
Well, I think the real issue is whether these techniques actually are productive.
Right.
Because I'm of a school with regard to counterterrorism, and I've done consulting on counterterrorism. I'm very committed to it. I'm not a bleeding heart liberal in that regard. I think, if we've got evidence that somebody's trying to kill our children, we have a responsibility to act first.
Right.
But I think that police work of detective work is how you roll those things up. And the idea that you're going to break up Al-Qaeda by data mining all of Verizon's records for 3 months.
Right.
Just strikes me as daft. I mean, it's typical of a kind of blind faith in quantitative methods that
right.
dominates some of our social science now too, as well as counterterrorism. And while I don't have a security clearance, so I don't know. I mean, I couldn't tell you if any very serious threat has ever been rolled up because they keep these things secret in this way. I'd be very surprised. And the ones that we know about, we didn't get bin Laden that way.
Right.
We haven't gotten Ayman al-Zawahiri that way.
Right.
The big threats that we know about that have been broken up haven't been because of this kind of surveillance. And even, I think, big mistakes are made because that's another thing that this kind of surveillance can go wrong easily. For instance, those Yemeni boys up at Lackawanna, New York, they were under email surveillance, and some of them went to a wedding in Bahrain, said it's going to be a really big feast. And, the New York Times revealed that the intelligence analysts were wondering, is feast a code word for a bomb? But no,
right.
They were going to a wedding. So
feast was a feast.
Drawbacks in just casting a wide net.
Right, and I think for that matter, the successes have not been reflected as far as we know in these programs, and the failures, have, such as what happened in Boston, were not anticipated by these programs either. So that point is very well taken. I want to move just for the final section of this to Turkey. Protests there are ongoing, and I'm curious just for our listeners, what was the kind of impetus behind the protest? What launched them, and what was the sort of initial response of the Turkish government?
Well, the initial protest was about a park in the European part of Istanbul. It was green, and the trees were 70 years old, and the current government in Turkey is more or less a neoliberal government. That is to say, it values the market as a way of getting social work done.
Right.
And so plans were made to turn that nice green park into a mall. You know, it would be like putting the Mall of America in Central Park in New York. Not exactly on that scale, but that's just to give you an idea of what was going on. So there were people who were attached to that green space, and the area around it, by the way, is a kind of bohemia. It's a kind of place where people gather in the evening to sit at cafes and drink beer, and there are nightclubs and tea houses where folk music is played. So it's a kind of counterculture, bohemia kind of atmosphere. There's also retail. It's all mixed up together. So, but I think people, in part, were not only protesting against those trees being torn down and the green space going away, but they were protesting that it was being done by fiat from the Prime Minister's office. And they were protesting against a general sense of regimentation, of police brutality, of being pushed around by central government, which is not new with this government. The AKP government that's in power now is not very different from its predecessor in those regards. But there's a, you know, there's a growing middle class in Turkey, educated, hooked in with the world, who just minds that kind of regimentation. And so that was part of what was being protested.
Yeah, so it's interesting to me, you know, in terms of Turkey, because basically in my understanding of the Turkish context is that the AKP government came into power, I believe, in 2003. And this was, I think, yes, it's a neoliberal party. It's also it's an Islamic party, but I would say it's much more it's better to think of it in terms of maybe like Christian Republicans in the United States, much more analogous to that than something like, well, certainly than something like Saudi Arabia or another kind of very extreme. It's a religious party or a religious government. It's not like that at all. But there is this certain religious conservatism and market focus in the party. And it seemed that the opposition to them for a long time in Turkey came from kind of remnants of the older secular order, which probably had some legitimate criticisms, but didn't have a great democratic record itself and kind of resented being usurped. But it seems like what's happening now, there's an environmental component to this. There's an emerging middle class component to this. There's a broader kind of more genuine liberal thing happening. That's been my read on it. Is that a fair read?
Oh, yeah. I think it's a very canny analysis. I think once the government pushed back so harshly against the protesters over the park issue, that it set the young people's nerves on edge. Now, one thing to say is that the people involved in the protests are young. These are 20-somethings for the most part, right? And a lot of them were just kids when this government came to power. It's been elected three times. It came to power first in 2002. And so they've grown up with it, and some of them are tired of it, but they're tired of the regimentation. And you know, the soccer fans in Turkey are kind of rowdy, and a lot of them are, you know, they're not religious people, let us say. And so, although they might not be committed secularists, they mind the religious tinge. And the government in Turkey, although it has origins in Muslim movements, most of its policies have not been particularly religious. They have been conservative. So, but recently the Prime Minister announced that you couldn't buy beer after 10. There would be an early last call.
Oh.
Well, you know, there are a lot of countries where you can't order after 11. So it's not the end of the world, maybe. But a lot of the young people, you know, took it as a symbol that there's this starting to, because this alcohol is forbidden in Islam, and maybe this is the beginning of that kind of regimentation. Or, and you know, they put restrictions on abortion. Just I think the analogy you made to the religious right in the United States is very apt. So it's, yeah, as you say, it's nothing like Saudi Arabia or Iran or anything like that. It's a secular country. It's got a secular constitution, and the party, you know, hasn't really pushed Islamic issues, but at the margins, it's pushed, you know, a kind of social conservatism. So a lot of the young people are pushing it back against that. And then once the crackdown began, some of the labor unions joined in and announced strikes. And the labor unions in Turkey are very weak. They were destroyed by the old secular military government. But they still are there as, you know, weak shadows of their former selves. And so they seem to be galvanized by this, and they're mobilizing again against the neoliberal emphasis of the government of you know, it's encouraged real estate speculation. The property keeps getting high. People can't afford to keep their apartments. There's all these new buildings going up and malls, and you know, in some ways it's progress, but it has victims.
Right, and there is this neoliberal flavor, and I guess what I'm curious about, and I know you have to be, obviously, one has to be very careful in kind of drawing these sort of comparisons, and the movements, you know, I obviously in a place like Egypt are radically different than something like Occupy, and are different than something that's going on in Turkey, but I think what's interesting that's happening now is it seems to me that this is the first type of movement that we've seen in what maybe could be called a second world country or a, you know, a developing and growing place that's not quite conventionally first world yet, or however we want to use those terms. But there is this kind of heavy backlash in some respects towards neoliberalism in Turkey. And do you think that it's obviously specific to the Turkish situation, but is that connected with currents in Europe and the rest of the Middle East? Does it say something broader beyond the Turkish situation?
Well, I think that, you know, we could now start talking about a whole string of youth anti-neoliberalism movements. There was one in Israel, right, in the summer of 2011, yeah. And it was about apartment rents for young people to some extent, and it had a great success. It was one of the most important recent Israeli social movements. The indignados, the indignant ones in Spain, you know, have some similarities,
right?
And they also were protesting neoliberalism, and especially the way, you know, neoliberalism is very much implicated in the real estate collapse and the economic collapse in Spain, even though many of those policies were pursued by a socialist government, that the policies themselves were somewhat neoliberal,
right.
And so in Chile you've had huge demonstrations. The government was headed by a billionaire and wanted to raise the fees for education, and the students came back and said, "Well, no, we want free education." I mean, that's a typical neoliberal kind of move on the government's part to have education be a market, right, in which
right.
people would pay for the certification as middle class people, so as to raise their incomes in life. And and the young people were arguing that no, education is like water; it's a public good; it should be free. And there's just been enormous student demonstrations in Chile, Colombia as well. So I mean, these things don't get a lot of press because they don't seem obviously connected to one another. And while they can be quite large and quite significant domestically, they don't seem to have a lot of international resonances. But I think since 2008, there have been fair numbers of these things, and that Turkey's has many similarities to the others.
Oh, that's fascinating. And the final question on Turkey, do you think, it seems to me, you know, Prime Minister Erdogan, you know, I've heard him compared to a Turkish George W. Bush. He's very confident. He's well, unlike Bush, he did win genuine large election victories. But his response has been to call the protesters vandals, hooligans, be pretty dismissive. Other ministers in his government have actually taken a much more conciliatory tone. Do you think that that's good cop, bad cop, or is there a genuine possibility of some different instincts inside the AKP government, and how do you think this might all sort of turn out?
Oh, I think the AKP government is very internally divided, and that Erdogan has a particular point of view on things coming from his own biography.
Right.
You know, he was once put in jail by the old secular military government for reading a poem.
Mm.
And the poem likened minarets to spears.
Yes.
So the government charged him with terrorism and put him in jail.
Right.
And, you know, if you were a kind of a religious and observant Muslim in Turkey under the secular military government, you were not a happy camper. You know, girls couldn't go on college campuses or in public buildings with a veil. People were, you know, it wasn't like American secularism, which when the government's supposed to be neutral towards religious movements. It was like the French, where the government considered it religion to be like smoking, you know, it's a public health problem that should be discouraged. And so he fought all his life against this, what he saw as religious discrimination. And when he finally got into power and he won all these elections, he got real pushback. There was danger of a military coup from the secularists. So he thinks, as far as I can tell from his speeches, that the old secular party, the Republican People's Party, is secretly behind these demonstrations, that they're manifestations of a political plot against him to undo the results of democratic, free, and fair elections. This is just a kind of coup by protest.
Right.
And that's why he says things like, well, we'll teach them real politics, and about 7 months we'll have elections, and I'll beat the pants off them again. And so I think he doesn't understand what's going on. He doesn't understand this is a youth movement. He doesn't understand why people would be upset about progress like a new mall instead of these old trees. So it's just his blinders, I think.
Right, but I guess to be fair, he does have a pretty unique political biography and some genuine accomplishments to his credit, and unfortunately he can't stay current and kind of anticipate what's going on now, maybe because of those blinders, as you say. Professor Cole, thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate you having you on.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed the conversation.
Here is Bill O'Reilly on the set with Monica Crowley and Alan Combs.
Here's how we're going to reform Medicare and Social Security. And the man refuses to
do
it.
Yes,
it is.
He has said he was willing to cut his program.
Hold it, because now I'm getting teed off of you. Give me one damn program he said he cut.
He has cut entitlements. He has cut
entitlements. One program.
What do you want to yell at?
Well, because you're lying.
I'm not lying.
You are lying.
Don't call me a liar. Don't you sit there and call me a liar.
No, you're lying.
I'm not lying.
Hey, here's the proof.
You don't like the president. You don't like what he's doing.
Give
me. Don't sit there and call me a liar.
I am.
Hold on for a second, folks. Medicare, which is an entitlement, is a program. There have been, remember the last election? He cut $700 billion from Medicare. He did. Now, there's a difference between benefits and cuts to a program. Those were payments to doctors, but he cut that. He froze federal pay. The deficit has been shrinking at a rate that it hasn't shrunk in 70 years over the past 3 years.
Give me one program.
We can have a disagreement whether you're calling me a liar. That's not necessary.
No, you're lying.
That's not necessary.
You are lying.
I'm not lying. We have
a
disagreement. There's a difference between having a disagreement and calling me a liar.
Yeah.
That's a personal
attack. This is why I'm calling you a liar. Give me one program he said he cut.
He would cut Medicare and Medicaid.
That's he offered cuts to those.
You asked me a program. Those are programs.
All right.
Those are programs.
Okay. You know, when he has said anything that even approaches what you're saying, Alan, he doesn't mean it. I'll give you a specific example.
I want to say with Combs. All right? Because I don't usually do what I just did to him. I asked him four times, Combs, to give me one specific program.
Medicare.
Out of all the federal budget, $3.2 trillion worth of spending that Obama said he would cut.
He would cut. He has actually hurt himself.
Give me one.
I said he has hurt himself with his base. Because
this is basically Bill O'Reilly saying, name for me one person who works here at this network. Sean Hannity. No! No! Wow. Bill O'Reilly just made an ass of himself. All right, folks. It's time for Random Rush. It's 1:28, 16 p.m. on the East Coast. I listen to Rush Limbaugh for 60 seconds. I respond to him in 90. Let's see if he's on.
You know, I'm supposed to get them every week. It could go, you know, $241. That's all I live off of for a whole week. Now, with food stamps, you know, I had to get help, you know, because, you know, I was raising a son. Here I am, you know, disabled, going through all this
stuff. Okay, so, but I'm still, what I'm trying to get at, Jennifer, here is, why did you call Snerdly and want to tell him all this and then tell me? Misunderstand. I'm just trying to figure out where we're going here. I hear you, and it's terrible what's happened to you, but.
I know. I'm just nervous. last year, I was receiving just $100 with food stamps. This past January, it got knocked down to $50 a month.
Well, but wouldn't you rather live not needing any of this stuff?
I would love it, Rush, but it's so hard when I mean, I am a very humble person.
It sounds to me, as I listen to your plight, I mean, you're sitting there, maybe justifiably angry at this rotten, no good company that you worked for. But it sounds to me, when you start talking about food stamps, it sounds like it's Obama that's taking food out of your mouth.
Well, you know, and it's kind of hard because here I am, you know, trying to, you know, that helps me out a little bit, and I'm very, very, you know, thankful, and yeah, I would like to get off of the system. You know, I don't cheat the system, never have, never will, but $50 is like buying milk, bread, and eggs, and he's, you know.
Well, Michelle Obama says you shouldn't be eating that kind of thing anyway. If you went to, like, tofu, I don't know, you might save some money that way.
All right. I went along because I had to.
That was amazing.
That is a prime example of Rush Limbaugh trying to figure out how he's going to get out of this situation where every type of person that he has built a career on demonizing calls in some fashion, gets through, and then somehow it doesn't work out. I don't know if he thought Snerdly, his producer, had some type of hook on this or not. But here it is. Here's a woman talking about how she's barely making it by on food stamps. And, of course, he would demonize her at any other time except for when he's face-to-face with her and his audience is seeing it. So his only response can be, well, Michelle Obama doesn't want people eating milk, eggs, and cheese. Stunning. I don't even know if there's anything I need to say to respond to this other than Rush Limbaugh just got punked by his own inability to continue to demonize the people he demonizes on a daily basis.
No, I think it's interesting because this woman was definitely a regular Rush Limbaugh listener. It just sounded like that. I think he was shocked at how to approach, like, yes, a lot of my audience is actually on these programs I demonize, but how do I approach this on my show when talking with one of them?
Right, of course. Generally, these people don't make it through this call screening. All right, that's a minute, 20 seconds. I went a little short because I let him go a little long.
It was just too good to not let
go. That was too good. I wanted to make sure that we had time to play this clip from Elizabeth Warren on CNBC the other day. It's an extended clip. It's 5 minutes long. But it is really just fantastic. So much so that even Jim Cramer tweeted out yesterday, there's this weird idea that Elizabeth Warren somehow bested CNBC yesterday on. And she is on there talking about the introduction of a new Glass-Steagall bill. And we can talk more about, for those who are not familiar, as to why we need this now. I think it's quite obvious in terms of Too Big to Fail has gotten even bigger than it was. And the implications, some will argue that it may or may not have stopped the financial crisis of 2008, but it certainly would have helped mitigate its impact in many respects. But here is Elizabeth Warren on with the CNBC morons, and it was really enjoyable. And understand, too, that Glass-Steagall would probably also in some ways inhibit CNBC's value to its dwindling viewership, because it just the go-go, you know, when you don't have the resources that you have when you have joined forces with a commercial bank and you're an investment bank, it probably makes you a little bit more conservative in your choices. At the very least, you have far less ability to do as much systemic damage. But here is that clip now.
Senator, I'm going to just jump in here and, sure. and ask you what you would say to some of the criticisms of your proposed bill here. For example, we were speaking to Chris Whalen earlier on today from Carrington Investment Services. And he was saying it would be hugely disruptive to impose this new Glass-Steagall. And one of the things that he says could be a result is it would really hurt credit creation, which obviously in turn would hurt the economy. What would you say, for example, to that?
You know, that was pretty much what the banks were saying back in 1932 and 1933. They kept saying no, no, no to Glass-Steagall. They raised all kinds of objections to it. And they kept hammering away at it because they wanted to be able to get access to those deposits in order to fuel more speculative trading. And what this says is no, we can't do that. If you're going to have FDIC insurance, you're going to have savings accounts and checking accounts. They really do have to be walled off. Remember, we have 50 years following the passage of Glass-Steagall in which we had a tiny number of bank failures. That whole boom and bust cycle from 1797 to 1933 went away. And in that period of time, we built a strong, robust middle class. What happened is we started chipping away, and part of the chipping away at that was to say, load up the banks with more and more risk, get them more integrated, and let them get bigger and bigger. And when that happened, we were in the position of having to bail them out when they got into big financial trouble.
Senator, I will push back, though, on the relative security that you're portraying Glass-Steagall to have given us, because Continental Illinois in the early 80s was the seventh largest bank in America. It failed, almost set off basically another major banking crisis. Shouldn't we just tell the American consumer that no matter what we do, there will be bank boom and bust cycles, no matter what the laws and regulations? You can't protect.
Okay, before now, Elizabeth Warren has a response to this, but the response that occurred to me was that the guy said, we almost had a banking crisis. So we had the one of the largest banks in the country go under, and we almost had a banking crisis. I wonder what it was that prevented it from being a systemic crisis. I wonder. This guy barking up the wrong tree and clearly just has, you know, this is one of those instances, and we mentioned it with Josh Fox on the program yesterday when he went up against Niall Ferguson on Bill Maher, where you love to see someone who has an inch deep worth of awareness of what the issue is because they've gotten talking points against someone who really does know what they're talking about. And here's Elizabeth Warren responding.
Everything. No. That is just wrong.
Why?
Look at the history.
I have looked at history. We're filled with booms and busts from the Dutch tulip crisis to now.
From 1797 to 1933, the American banking system crashed about every 15 years. In 1933, we put good reforms in place for which Glass-Steagall was the centerpiece. And from 1933 to the early 1980s, that's a 50-year period, we didn't have any of that. None. We kept the system steady and secure. And it was only as we started deregulating, you start hitting the S&L crisis, and what did we do? We deregulated some more. And then you hit long-term capital management at the end of the 90s, and what did we do as a country? This country continued to deregulate more. And then we hit the big crash in 2008. You are not going to defend the proposition that regulation can never work.
I didn't say regulation never worked, Senator, by far and away, and I agree there were fewer bank failures in that time after Glass-Steagall.
Fewer, as in of the big ones, zero.
But Continental Illinois was the seventh biggest bank in the United States when it failed.
It took 50 years to get there.
But Senator, you're on the record saying Glass-Steagall would not have prevented the financial crisis.
Not all by itself. That's absolutely right. But what Glass-Steagall can do is it can wind some more of the risk out of the system. It can help bring down the size of the largest banking institutions. Don't forget, you said there was too much concentration in the banking industry in 2008. Now here we are in 2013, and the big four are 30% bigger. That puts too much risk back in the system.
Well, there's other ways of shrinking them, obviously. But
with all due respect, Senator, every report I've read, every person I've spoken to says that there's a very, very, very slim chance of this even passing.
Well, let me put it this way. If you don't fight for it, the chances are zero.
I love this. Well, now that we've decided that we can't really comment on that, we can't make the argument that your policy is bad, do you think there's any chance of it passing? I remind you that I do not know that these CNBC people have ever said to a single Republican congressperson, hey, you've tried to repeal Obamacare 67 times. It has failed. Why do you guys keep doing this? This is the first time this bill is going to come up.
Remember who my partners are in this one. I've got John McCain standing with me. I couldn't ask for a better fire. We've got Maria Cantwell. We've got Angus King. We've got a Democrat, a Republican, an Independent. All people who are willing to get out there and fight. Senator, you know
what the prospects are. The House has voted 37 times to... on Obamacare to defund it. Is this any different? I mean, you're making a statement, but we want Congress to do things that actually have a chance of happening and become law.
You know, is this any different? And now, the fact is it's actually been 67, but this guy says 37. Is it any different to try and bring this up in a bipartisan fashion one time in the Senate as opposed to what the Republicans are doing? I mean, this is just...
Also, he brought up the Obamacare thing to Elizabeth Warren. I doubt he's ever brought it up to a Republican.
Exactly. Go ahead.
This seems like more of the
same.
Go ahead.
No, but I was just going to say, you know, I remember going on television multiple times, including here, when I talked about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, when the big banks were spending more than $1 million a day lobbying against it, and when everybody told me, you'll never get that thing through. Why are you even trying? The chances of passing it are slim to none. And yet, look around. We now have a good, strong Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. It's recovered $500 million for families who got cheated. It's out there working on behalf of military families, on behalf of seniors, on behalf of students. We got that agency because we got out and fought for it. I actually believe in that.
Well, okay. Well, we've got to move on. And so, of course, this is what I want to read just again. Jim Cramer's tweet from yesterday. There's some weird strain of thought that CNBC got beaten by Senator Warren. I like the senator, but she had no, capital N-O, impact.
Hmm.
Wow. There you go, folks. All right. Well,
let me tell you, I've seen this video passed so much that I'll guarantee you the impact of this interview has brought awareness to that bill.
Absolutely. Unbelievable. Absolutely. Not only did she not have no impact, I would imagine this is a surprising net gain for the chances of this bill to pass, particularly since had she not handed it to him, nobody would have seen this video because nobody watches CNBC.
There's always a powerful end to a debate when you're just like, huh.
Huh. Well,
had no impact on me.
Let's go back to pushing Lehman Brothers. I think this is a buy. Oh, wait, did they still? Okay. A lot of people say Republicans, you know, they just deny the idea of man-made climate change. They're not coming around. But, you know, Smokey Joe Barton. Oh, I should mention he's a Republican congressman who sits, is he the chair of the Energy Committee from Texas? He certainly sits on it. He is a Republican. There's a reason why they call him Smokey Joe, and it's not because he smokes a lot. It's because he is one of the biggest recipients of fossil fuel lobbying money and carbon-based energy lobbying money of anyone in Congress. And has, I don't know if they rate him, but he would have an A rating. He is going to explain to you exactly why there is some confusion about the science behind climate change, folks. Listen carefully here.
Recognize the gentleman from Texas, Mr. Barton, for 5 minutes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think it's a secret that I'm a proponent and supporter of the Keystone Pipeline, so it's somewhat redundant for me to ask too many questions. So I would point out, though, that people like me that support hydrocarbon development.
Now, you got to say, you got to give it up for him. At least he's being obvious. Now, they call him Smokey Joe, and I don't know if that's written in front of his little placard in Congress as he's holding these hearings on Keystone. But so, you know, credit for that. And he's gonna put up his best argument. Go ahead.
Don't deny that the climate is changing. I think you could have an honest difference opinion on what's causing that change without automatically being either all in that it's all because of mankind or it's all just natural. I think there is a divergence of.
The point isn't whether or not you can have a difference of opinion about this. That's not what the difference of opinion is about. The difference of opinion is, am I going to listen to the vast majority, the 95% of climate scientists around the world who are saying that this is man-made or not? That's the opinion. That's the binary choice here. We can all have opinions as to whether or not this is that. But it's just basically, this is not like I prefer the Red Sox. I prefer the Texas Rangers. This is whether or not I'm going to believe the scientists or decide not to. And then my rationales for both of those.
Maybe the opinion here is to not listen to the facts.
Yeah, but that's like a predisposition. That's not even an opinion. I'm going to think that science is bunk. But wait a second. Let's let him talk.
Evidence. I would point out that if you're a believer in the Bible, one would have to say the Great Flood is an example of climate change. And that certainly wasn't because mankind had overdeveloped hydrocarbon energy.
All right. So there you have it. Because one of the things, in my opinion, that I'm skeptical about what the scientists say, because if you happen to believe in the Bible like I do, in the Great Flood when Noah had his ark, that was probably climate change. The climate changed. And I don't think that was because people were driving too many cars.
The proof is right there. It's in a book.
He's got such a almost Cheshire grin on his face, though. Like, I love pure cynicism.
I can't believe I'm saying this. And what I really can't believe is it's going to work. It's going to work with my constituency.
It's total, like, not bad work if you can find it.
Yeah, I can't believe I get away with this. I almost feel like, am I mocking myself by even sort of being trying to analyze that statement? Am I mocking myself by saying, you know, let's just let's stipulate the Great Flood happened.
And that ark did exist.
And let's stipulate the ark did exist. I know that they may have found it somewhere in the who knows.
And that one of every animal.
And one of every animal is on. And let's just stipulate that it was climate change. Obviously, if you have a massive flood, the climate has changed in some respects. Is it possible, I would ask Joe Barton, if we were actually to have a serious conversation about this where he wasn't going like, come on, Sam. Not really. I mean, come on now. Is it possible that it was just sort of more localized than maybe the people writing this story in the Bible were aware of at the time? Like maybe the phone lines were down and they didn't know that, you know, in other parts of the world, this wasn't happening, and they just assumed, like when they referred to the world, they were really just talking about a very small region that may have flooded. Well, Sam, that's your opinion, and we could never know.
Actually, you'd probably say, well, Sam, I can't believe you thought about it that much.
Exactly. Well, Sam, I am mighty disappointed in you.
You, what are you doing? Don't you got some Twitter wars to fight?
Are you supposed to be an educated modern man, Sam? You know, David Cross, for crying out loud.
My God, what an a-hole you just made yourself look like taking me seriously, Sam. God.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice was made. Option where you don't get paid for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive.